Hello there, Buzzkillers. I was recently interviewed on a wonderful new podcast. It's called The All-American Legacy. It's about the 82nd Airborne Division of the United States Army. It's a division that's been around a long time. Even before they invented military airplanes, the 82nd was going. Lots of famous people, lots of very important people have been in that division. And we talked a lot about not only war, but how the myths of war sort of are generated and how they spread. And they've recently aired that show, that interview with me and another historian. And we liked it so much, we thought the Buzzkillers would like to hear it as well. So we're re-releasing it, with their permission, of course, to our listeners on our feed. And I hope you like it. But before we do that, I want to do something called a pre-roll. Because this is one of our episodes, we want to have a big, nice shout-out to our sponsors, Harry's Razors. I know that all victorious military leaders and all the people who liberated Europe were fans of Harry's Razors. Even before the internet was invented, they got on the telegraph and they typed out their message to harrys.com, please send me your fantastic razors. Those fantastic razors not only support the show and keep us going, they have a soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for hard to reach places, lubricating strip, textured handle. I've got a Hunter Green one. It's fantastic looking. It's kind of army green, frankly, for more control when it's wet. And Harry's only charges $2 a blade, compared to, you know who, the big ripoff razor companies that charge you $4 or more, right? Harry's isn't like that. Why? Because two guys, Jeff and Andy, saw the vast wasteland of the razor world, and they realized not only was the great opportunity to start a good new business, but it was the right thing to do. They went out and bought a razor factory in Germany. They make their own razors, directly sell them to you for half the price of the ripoff razor companies, and they keep quality control right under their noses, so to speak. And their blades are still just $2 compared to the $4 or more you pay for those big ripoff razor companies. And most importantly, for you anyway, Harry's has a special offer for Buzzkillers. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. The free trial set includes the razor, the five-blade cartridge, the shaving gel. You just pay $3 for shipping, something like that. But when you get to checkout, enter the code BUZZKILL, B-U-Z-Z-K-I-L-L, and they'll add in their post-shave balm for free. The post-shave balm is great. It's gotten me through many a Northern Hemisphere winter. You'll look better, your face will feel better all day when you use it. Of course, your Harry's subscription plan is customizable. We wouldn't advertise anything that wasn't customizable in terms of shipping frequency, and you can cancel at any time. Let me go over that again. Harrys.com, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Enter the code BUZZKILL, two Z's, two L's, at checkout. You'll get a great razor blade, shave cream, and the post-shave balm for free, and you'll have a whole new world of better and more affordable shaves. Now, let's go on to the All-American Legacy podcast, featuring yours truly.
Hey, podcast listeners, Master Sergeant Dan Bailey here. We said at the end of last week's episode we were going to take a look at what happened to the division between World War I and World War II this week. But we had an opportunity to speak with a couple of knowledgeable folks that shared some very good information about the redeployment of the 82nd, back to the States, and the situation they returned to at home. We'll have the post-World War I episode next week. To help set the scene for this week's episode, I'm going to quickly share a summary of a memorandum from the 82nd Division Chief of Staff, impressing upon the soldiers they must now prepare to return to civilian life, and that preparation was as important and difficult as their initial military training. Memorandum to Headquarters, 82nd Division, 17 March, 1919. Within a short time, all but a few members of the division will return to civil life, and they should be as well fitted to take up civil pursuits as the present conditions permit. The conditions in the United States will be found very different from those which prevailed at the time the division left, and the great economic readjustment caused by the termination of the war is now in process of changing the conditions and customs with which most of us are familiar. Every help will be given to the members of this division to ensure their fitting into the peacetime system at home, but it must be impressed on all that the future of the individual and civil life will depend primarily on his own qualities, character, and initiative, and any assistance that can be rendered is supplementary. Members of the command should realize that, because of the part they took in the operations during this war, They have the opportunity and the obligation to become leaders in the life of the nation at home, and they will be expected to assume that position. This is an opportunity and an obligation of the greatest importance, for the future of the United States now lies in our hands. Team play, rather than individual or factional struggles, will lead to the true solution of the difficulties ahead. Signed, Lieutenant Colonel George E. Roosevelt, 82nd Division, Chief of Staff.
This is the 82nd Airborne Division, fearless among fighting units.
From Fort Bragg, home of the Airborne and the center of the military universe, this is the All-American Legacy Podcast. An inside look at the 100-year history of the 82nd.
They are All-American all the way.
Welcome back to the All-American Legacy Podcast. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Joe Bacino. Today we've got a few guests joining us as we wrap up our discussion on World War I. First on the show is Dr. Jennifer Keene. She is the History Department Chair at Chapman University. She's the author of several books about World War I, to include one titled World War I, The American Soldier Experience, which is a look back at the daily lives of the men who served the United States in the Great War. She really is an expert in this field about the mobilization for war, the conduct of the war, and then the return of our soldiers to America. Then later in the show, we're going to talk to Dr. Joseph Kuhill, who you might know better as the host of the hit podcast Professor Buzzkill. And we're going to talk some World War I and II myths and see what he has to say. But for now, we're joined by Dr. Jennifer Keene.
Good afternoon. We'll start off with a simple question here, one that many of our listeners may not know the answer to, which you are certainly more than qualified to answer. This is an easy one for you. So the American public, we know, referred to its World War I infantrymen as doughboys. The All-American Division was, for the most part, doughboys. So what is the origin of that title?
It's interesting that you start with a question that has actually no definitive answer. People aren't really exactly sure where that nickname originated from. It was a popular label that was initially attached to cavalrymen in the 19th century, and some people think it's because of the dust that collected as they were stationed along the southwest border. Another tale comes from uniforms in the late 19th century, in which the buttons had a kind of doughy shape to them. So it doesn't have a clear origin, but it certainly became one of the most popular nicknames that was attached to the American soldiers in the First World War.
Yeah, we're finding a lot of the names and titles, the origin, a lot of the names and the titles from 1917 and the early part of 1918, I guess they weren't fully documented. A lot of this is a little unclear.
Exactly. There's a whole bunch of army slang that comes into being. When we think of some of the other nicknames for American soldiers, Sammies, Yanks, or even Pershing's Crusaders, I think there's a more obvious direct connection to the First World War. We can think of Uncle Sam or Yankees or even the idea that America was on a crusade for democracy. All those things have a much clearer link to the actual First World War. Doughboys, a bit of a mystery, but it became a very popular term nonetheless.
Right. So part of the story of the 82nd Division in 1917 that we talk a lot about is the transition of civilians from all over the country to soldiers and then into a fighting force that was cohesive and able to conduct movement and maneuver in the Argonne Forest. And that's something you've written about extensively, not about the division, but about the War Department, about this broader problem across the Army. And so the Army, the War Department, and in our case, the 82nd, turned civilians into soldiers, and then leaders had to prepare them to train this war machine that was already years ahead of us. And our first commander, Major General Edwin Swift, was in a tough spot in this regard. So how did that experience shape the war, but also the post-war experience, this kind of newness of this experience and the notion of putting all of this together very quickly?
It was definitely true that in the First World War, the Army had a challenge it had never had before, which was that it had to take millions of men and transform them in a matter of a few months, as you say, to fight against very sophisticated, well-trained armies that had been in existence often before the First World War. Most European societies had a tradition of peacetime military conscription, so men had spent maybe 2 or 3 years already in military service before they even before their nations even entered the First World War. We didn't have anything like that. So it was a huge challenge for the American military, and when we often talk about the mistakes that were made during the First World War, we often neglect to really praise them for meeting this challenge as well as they did. And one of the things that the military realized, and Pershing realized right from the very beginning, was the need for standardization. So rather than allowing commanders or states to kind of come up with their own training programs, as had been the past previous, had been the practice in previous wars, they come up with a fairly rigid standardized training program. So that's one of the first important steps in creating a mass army. And they also enlist a lot of specialists. They turn to the civilian community and they bring in occupational specialists, they bring in psychologists to try to help them sort through all these men that are coming in. How can they actually identify quickly who should go to officer training camp, who should be a stevedore, who should be an infantryman, who's got the know-how to actually be in field artillery. And so they utilize these specialists to a certain extent. They also turn to the Allies. We have French and British instructors that come over and are helping get the American Army up to speed. So all of these are ways that they tackle this problem of very quickly turning civilians into soldiers. They didn't do it perfectly. A lot of mistakes were made. One of the reasons many historians believe there were such high casualties in the American Army would be because of some soldiers not receiving the training that they needed. But one of the things that really percolated in post-war society was the idea this lack of preparedness was not something America could afford for its national defense. And so you did have the idea of starting to require military training of American civilians. This doesn't happen, but it opens up the notion that we can't be caught left-footed again. And so as we move into the Second World War, we will actually have a peacetime draft. We start drafting men before we officially declare war, the idea we have to be better prepared if we're going to fight in this kind of conflict.
All right. You mentioned General Pershing. Dr. Keene, you mentioned General Pershing. We should just explain for those who are unfamiliar, General Pershing was the commander of all American forces, the American Expeditionary Forces in the Great War. So the division in this regard, as we're putting this thing together, the division was comprised of soldiers from all 48 states. That is now a very well-known fact, at least here, among people who follow this division. We also had soldiers of foreign birth. About 20% of the division were immigrants. And when you read the accounts from the leaders in the St. Mihiel Offensive, it was hard for the division to communicate with one another in some cases because of the broad diversity of accents, obviously American accents, Southern, Northern, Western, and then foreign accents. So across the Army, across the American forces, how did this diversity impact the fight against this enemy that was much more homogenous?
This is another respect in which the 82nd Division is really representative of the entire American force. 20% of the division being foreign-born, this was actually exactly the same percentage of foreign-born in the entire Army. So immigrant soldiers, this was not a small issue for the Army. This was major. And as you suggested, this introduced a whole new set of issues for the military. They had to think about language. They had to think about food. They had to think about religion. They had to think about just basic communication and camaraderie among men who came from incredibly different backgrounds. And so in the training regime, besides just training people, physically to fight, there had to be a kind of political education and just remedial education that people were receiving. So you see English classes, classes in reading, you see classes in patriotism, understanding American political history. If you want people to actually fight for the same country, do they even know the values of the country that they're fighting for? And what was interesting, I think, in all of this is that immigrants are not resistant. They're very pleased to be given these opportunities. These were people who had come to the United States. They'd chosen to make the United States their home, and many of them were very happy to fight for America. They had been, in some sense, isolated in ethnic enclaves and almost shut out from mainstream society up until this point. And now the Army was opening the door to them and saying, we want you to be assimilated. We want to help you with that process. So most immigrant soldiers were very willing to participate in these programs and were as patriotic as native-born troops. And so in this sense, having immigrant soldiers in the military did not diminish the fighting capacity of the American Army.
Our big moments in the war were Saint-Mihiel and then Meuse-Argonne. Meuse-Argonne was kind of our signature moment. How does the Meuse-Argonne offensive compare with the deadliest battles in U.S. history?
The Meuse-Argonne is an interesting battle. It's the longest and some people feel the most lethal battle in American history. It lasts for 47 days, and I think that it's for the Army at the time, it really demonstrates all its strengths and weaknesses. It's a battle that Pershing is not necessarily prepared to fight. He has to fight it in the fall of 1918. He always believed that his army would not be ready to fight a climactic battle until at least a year later. So some of the mistakes in the battle, you see the fact that these troops are being rushed into fight. So there are problems with maintaining momentum. You see some discipline problems. You see people just unable to cope with the very difficult terrain in the Meuse-Argonne. But then you also see some of the strengths of the American Army, which is the tremendously fast learning curve that the military was able to achieve. And so by the end of the battle, you see air power being used much more effectively. You see combined arms being used much more effectively. And I think that in this sense, that really does mimic a lot of the great battles in American history, where you see mistakes early on, but you also see tremendous learning on the ground and an ability to persevere and innovate at the moment. And I think the Meuse-Argonne fits very well into that narrative of American battlefield history.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what happened after the war. In March 1919, the 82nd Division began returning to the United States. In a general memorandum from March of 1919, the division chief of staff, which was at the time Lieutenant Colonel George Roosevelt, wrote that within a short time, all but a few members of the division will return to civil life, and they should be as well fitted to take up civil pursuits as the present conditions permit. And so it turns out it was not quite that easy. Reintegrating soldiers after global war was a new experience for us. How did the homeland receive our doughboys?
Well, I think that when we think about American soldiers coming back from the First World War, there's two ways to look at it. One is the initial public response, which was very patriotic. There were a lot of parades, a lot of speeches. In that sense, American soldiers were welcomed home as heroes. The day after the parade, there's very much the idea that the war's over. It's time for you as an individual to really figure out how you're going to pick up the pieces of your life. We talked a little bit about how unprepared the United States was to fight, to organize, to train this army. It was equally unprepared to demobilize this army and really think systematically about how to help veterans return home. And so there are few fledgling programs to try to help veterans find employment, very little attention paid to the psychological issues that combat veterans were going to come home with, And really, at the end of the day, the sense of overall dissatisfaction that so little had been done for the returning veteran. And this was going to be important because this memory that the Army and the government had not treated veterans appropriately, this was going to motivate this generation of veterans to become very politically active in the 1920s and the 1930s to both help their own situation and also to help future generations avoid the difficulties that they had encountered.
So you write in your book, Doughboys, you write about how World War I changed the meaning of U.S. military service. The book is Doughboys, The Great War and the Remaking of America. Those who fought in the Civil War and the Spanish-American War fought largely for and with their individual states. In World War I, our Doughboys fought in this first national mass fighting force. So this is particularly important for us, the All-American Division, which broadly represented the character of the entire nation. What impact did this sort of forced notion of national cohesion have on the country after more than 4 million soldiers returned from the war and re-entered American society?
So the idea that you have been part of a national army, not just a member of a state unit or a local regiment, this really impacted how veterans saw themselves. They saw themselves as unified and having gone through very similar experiences. In this sense, they saw the Army as a great melting pot in which it no longer really mattered whether you were from the North, the South, the East, or the West. It still mattered if you were black or white, but other traditional divisions seemed less important. And this attitude helped a brand new veterans organization, the American Legion, really become the spokesman for returning veterans. And the American Legion, we see, now takes stands on big national issues. It doesn't just think about local issues. And this was something veterans hadn't really done before. They hadn't been players in sort of big national debates that had to do with immigration, defense issues, the Red Scare and concerns about communism, and then, of course, veterans' benefits and how we were treating our veterans when they came home. And so the sense that these soldiers had developed more of a national identity as Americans while fighting the war also informed veteran politics after the war. And because the American Legion becomes a very powerful lobbying group in post-war American society, it mattered that veterans had this new perspective.
So the soldiers came back to a confusing place in America immediately after World War I. Racial violence on the rise, and the country was in a significant recession. The Red Scare brought on fear of immigrants. So we think about the country is divided today. There seems to be these kind of threads, these kind of trends throughout our history. So how did the return of these veterans shape American society in the aftermath of the war?
Well, it's interesting. We certainly have political divisions today, and we have arguments, but what you're referring to in 1919 is actual violence. I mean, we had really, it's not an exaggeration to say blood running in the streets with strikes, with race riots, with concerns about Bolshevism, and this was a really, really violent time. The question about how veterans fit into this is a great one, because it's important to appreciate that veterans did not instigate this violence. They, in a sense, returned home to a society that was already fighting. And the group that's probably the most directly connected to this violent time in terms of maybe engaging in it and also suffering from it are African American soldiers, because African American soldiers are targeted in many Southern communities with violence. And we see a new ethos in the civil rights movement coming into being, which is an ethos of fighting back. And so we see African American soldiers also joining civil rights organizations in large numbers and taking leadership roles and really making a decision to fight for racial justice in the United States. But for many white veterans, what we really see is that they move away from the idea of trying to solve social problems violently. And so I was just speaking about the American Legion. The American Legion is very careful to discipline posts where it might appear that local groups might be looking to them sort of as auxiliaries to the police force. They don't want to get directly involved in these kind of law and order issues. So they pull back and really offer a different way of resolving some of the disputes, and that's mostly by lobbying Washington, looking for veterans' benefits. They're big in a movement called the Adjusted Compensation Movement, where they want veterans to have a bit more money to help them ease their life after the war. And so, if anything, I see these returning veterans as being part of peaceful solutions to resolving these divisions, not as men who have been trained to fight who are now ready to take up arms to defend their points of view within American society.
You hear this a lot, not a lot, but you do hear it sometimes, that we've never been this divided, and certainly ideologically people have corners right now and there are peaceful protests, but the notion that we've never been this divided is ignorant completely of history.
You have to look at 1919 before you say something like that.
Right.
There's no doubt that in 1919, like I said, you literally have people fighting in the streets.
Right.
That, you know, we really have very vocal disagreements, but people are, as you pointed out, are demonstrating peacefully. There's civil disagreement. We're using the proper channels through the courts and through our elected representatives to articulate our differences. And I think that demonstrates the strength of American political institutions. Even the fact that in 1919, even with that violence, it does not result in any sort of dramatic weakening of American democratic institutions. And I should point out, there's always a fear when you take a bunch of men out of civilian life, you teach them how to use firearms and they fight. Who are these people coming back? Are they going to come back as killers? Are they ready to actually, you know, be part of paramilitary groups to seek violent solutions to disagreements? And if we look at Europe, we see that that's certainly a distinct possibility. In the interwar period, that's exactly what happens in Germany. But it's not what happens in the United States. And so that's a really important thing for us to remember, that these men, for the most part, do successfully reintegrate into civilian society. They do believe that they've fought to maintain a democratic way of life. And while our democracy was certainly not perfect, people remained invested in that concept of America. And that's what they had been told and taught when they became citizen soldiers, and they did not lose that faith, even despite the difficulties that they had on the battlefields or even coming home.
Yeah. I told my daughter that, you know, our institutions have worked through this before on a much larger scale, on a much more ferocious scale, the reintegration of soldiers from combat, the, you know, political upheaval, political uncertainty, and we're so grounded in our institutions that these foundational ideas and these instruments will always save us.
And I think that it's important that we have a military, and this military really came into being in the First World War, that sees its role as defending those institutions, and it never sets itself up in opposition to those institutions, where in other societies you have the military actually doing that, that it becomes an alternative source of power and authority as opposed to an institution that's in service of democracy. And I think that when you talk about creating a national army in the First World War and having immigrants and people from all walks of life coming in, this was a shared vision that the military took pains to actually ensure that everybody heard. There's a lot of propaganda within the military, or I say education within the military, to make sure that people understood this was their role as a soldier in uniform. And I think that people, it became in a sense a school for the nation. I mean, it's and at a time when a lot of people didn't go to school for very long. So this became an important patriotic education for people to have. And that's an important role for our military to continue to play, even in present-day society.
Our commander here for the division, he, whenever he does a reenlistment or a promotion ceremony, he reminds everyone that, you know, we take an oath to an idea, And that idea has to be protected by arms, and that's a role. That's a role in society. So
see, that's excellent, and that's a message that you can't say enough times. Yeah. And this is, and so when you talk about it being a national institution, that's a distinct difference to view that this is an important message for soldiers to hear, because everybody is first a citizen and then a soldier, and that's the right way to think about it. When you say, somebody's asking me the other day, what's the difference between a citizen soldier and just a soldier? And I think especially in America, it's important to always look at our soldiers as citizen soldiers, citizens first, and then you're a soldier.
Right. Okay, Dr. Keene, I really do appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks. Perfect. Take care. Right, we'll see you. Thanks.
Bye.
So that was Dr. Jennifer Keene. We want to thank her for her time and for coming on the podcast. We do hope people check out the book, Doughboys, The Great War and the Remaking of America. And now we transition to Dr. Joseph Kuhil, another historian. You probably know him. You may know him as Professor Buzzkill.
Dr. Kuhil has a doctorate in modern history from Oxford, as well as an MA from the University of Melbourne. He's published several books and many articles, and he's taught history at universities in Britain and the United States. Dr. Kuhil is an entertaining historian. He tells American history in a very compelling way, and we hope you find that to be the case here with this interview. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Professor Buzzkill, thanks for being on the All American Legacy podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Part of what you talk about very publicly is the challenges of determining historic truth. For a lot of our history, that's not a particularly big challenge. People recorded things and people are still here to provide their accounts from the Cold War deployments and Gulf War, Iraq and Afghanistan. But those things are not really the case with World War One.
Yeah, it's much more difficult. The further back you go, it's more difficult. And, of course, it's reliant on just print records, really, in World War One. Although, you know, all the military history experts that I talk to are very impressed with official histories in general, because official military history in general, because they go into such detail and they've got that added purpose that I think people forget of being a real teachable document. You know, the military wants to understand what happened so that it can improve its tactics and its strategy for the next time something like that happens. And so they really are careful. Obviously, mistakes creep in and there are political agendas and personal agendas. But overall, I think they're very good, especially as more time passes and people get better and better at them. I think the most crucial element in this is whoever gets the story in first. And often that's newspaper reporters or journalists of some kind. But when it comes to writing official histories or when there are interviews with people involved, usually the first version of the story gets accepted by everyone. Even if the first version of the story isn't accurate or is skewed in some way, after all, some people only see part of a battlefield, some people see only part of a whole offensive operation or whatever it is. And so the broad picture doesn't appear too much later, but then it's almost too late. And very often the first version of the story is the most dramatic and the most interesting and the most compelling. So it just gets taken up because these are, after all, good stories, or we wouldn't be bothering trying to understand and try to tell them if they weren't good stories.
Right. And how do historic myths, how do they manifest? How do they come into the collective consciousness?
Well, one of the ways is just simple mistakes along the lines of what I was saying, often the first version of the story or the first report of a story gets accepted as fact and just gets repeated and repeated. And so if there's something wrong with that story, a version of the story, then it just becomes accepted fact. But another thing that happens, and which is really kind of very interesting, and I didn't really realize until we did research here on how this happens, and that is that there's something called the removal of qualifiers. And so if I say to you that You know, the 82nd was one of the most important divisions in a particular action. And then someone else said, someone else hears in the show, Professor Buskill said, the 82nd was the most important division in a certain action. In other words, they drop words like very or a one of or brief or anything that has a modifier to the action verb gets dropped the further the story is passed on. It's like that game of telephone that you used to play as a kid, or it's like how, you know, urban legends start. So we say that Patton was one of many great generals. Well, by the time that gets to the third hand or fourth hand, it becomes Patton is the great general. If you know what I'm saying, people are dropping the first thing that people drop when they repeat stories is important qualifiers.
Right. Right. So, and I do think, you know, one of the things I've heard you talk about is the importance of understanding World War One. You know, in many ways, World War Two sort of, for the country, particularly for this division, but really for the country, World War Two blankets World War One. Certainly, I think we can understand that, but you know, World War One is so important to our understanding of the world right now. We're understanding the foundations of World War One. And our participation and how our participation really tipped the scales, the notion of modern empire, the notion of modern colonialism, all of these things can be understood better through an understanding of World War One.
Oh, absolutely. And not only is all that true, but what's also true but has been erased is the idea that World War One wasn't such a big deal, especially for the Americans, because the Americans are only in it for a year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in American culture at the time, World War One is a very, very big deal. Not only was the country heavily involved in supporting the Allies before the Americans actually got into the war, but participation in the war, the draft, raising of money, the raising of relief efforts for the Belgians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, was the first time really that the country had done things on that massive a scale. And a lot of the patriotic imagery, for instance, that we're used to seeing now, Uncle Sam and the increased use of the flag as the main iconic image of American patriotism, those all come from World War One. In fact, you could argue that even things like the GI Bill, which of course was implemented after World War Two, was really in a reaction to the bonus marchers after World War One, marching and protesting that they weren't getting their bonus, they wanted to get it early and during the Depression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So World War One had a huge impact not only on Europe and imperialism in the world, but on American political consciousness. It was the biggest thing until World War Two came along.
Right, and you know, when you think about our modern wars and our participation therein, you're talking about a very small, minuscule fragment of the country, you know, less than 1%, quite frankly.
That's right.
And you know, this was a little more than 10% of the country participated directly in World War One, but the entire country virtually participated in a larger way.
Yeah, that's right. Even the sort of campaign to knit socks for soldiers in the trenches and soldiers on the front was a huge deal for American women at home. And it was so much of a big deal that you would often see images of women knitting socks while they were listening to their kids' elementary school band play something. You know, that women were always knitting to keep the boys at the front, you know, in clean socks and try to stop trench foot and all that sort of stuff. So it really is a big national effort that tends to get forgotten nowadays.
It was a big national effort, and virtually every major population center was impacted in some way. You know, virtually every industry was impacted in some way. And we don't really have any current day parallel for that.
No, and I think one of the things that gets forgotten is how much World War One especially accelerates the use and the efficiency of technology at the time. So it becomes very, very important that telegraphs, for instance, technology is improved and speeded up. Radio gets much more important than ever before. wars, and particularly big wars, tend to do this. After all, one of the big reasons for the growth of the airline industry after World War II is that World War II greatly increased the sophistication and efficiency of you know, airplane technology. So we literally live day to day with some of the outgrowths of the importance of World War I and World War II.
One of the figures that emerges from our World War I history is Sergeant Alvin York. And yeah. So this is in many ways right up your alley with the things you talk about. A lot of controversy about what really happened.
Yeah, so, of course, your listeners will know all about Sergeant York, but he's one of the most famous, probably, soldier coming out of World War I, and for the Americans anyway. But people are always, as they should, going back over and trying to figure out, well, did these things really happen the way we've been told they happened? Did he really sort of capture 130 some odd German soldiers single-handedly, blah, 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 blah? And so historians and even people with archaeological bents have gone back over the old battlefields and looked at, tried to figure out, okay, this is where the hill you're supposed to have captured those men on was. They looked at shell casings, all those kinds of things, to try to determine whether the story is accurate or whether, as some other people have argued, I don't happen to agree with, the story was enhanced by the American government, not only to help raise war morale in 1918, but to increase the United States, to sort of increase the peace morale and the U.S. being involved in international affairs after World War I morale after the war. And Sergeant York was sent on speaking trips and all that kind of stuff after the war. Now, I think it's pretty clear that the record of what York did during the war was very accurate. But again, that's all. It's debated, as you say. So it's important to keep things. It's important to keep discussing these things, because when we discuss these things, then we think more deeply about history and about how the decisions we make based on history need to be thought about carefully. You know, as grown-ups, not just reacting the way we've seen things in movies.
Right, so the division participated in Meuse-Argonne. That's where we know. That's where we know of the story of Alvin York.
And the thing about Meuse-Argonne, which is really tragic, is when you ask Americans, or when Americans say what they think the bloodiest single day or the bloodiest single battle in American history was, they often say Antietam or Gettysburg or even D-Day. When it's really Meuse-Argonne, it's, you know, 12,500, I think, mm-hmm. men killed in that thing. It's a very, very big deal. And when every time I've thought about it and looked into it, I'm very, very impressed at how seriously not only military historians take it, but the people who were involved in the official War Graves Commission and things like that take it really up until this day. You can go on YouTube and see the various commemorations on specific anniversaries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There aren't many spectators there, but the Army's all there. And, you know, these things just get sort of buried by more flashy, if you will, battles and engagements.
So that's really what we're after here, and that understanding of you know, the division's role, and the division is well known for its airborne legacy. It had a great legacy in World War One, and its participation in World War One should be understood as well.
Yeah, and it is, of course, as we know, perhaps the most famous, specifically because of Meuse-Argonne. But again, those things, as you say, and as we say on our show, they tend to get steamrolled by subsequent history and flashier history. You know, airborne sounds more exciting, and certainly I'm sure parachuting out of an airplane is more exciting than being an infantryman. But in terms of what actually gets accomplished, it's amazing what was done in World War One. It was a very, especially by your division, it was a very, very big deal.
Right.
So I think what's so great about your podcast is that, you know, the more we know and the more we hear as a culture about what happened, we'll understand that history is not only more complicated, but that it's more compelling than we thought before. You know, that World War One isn't a boring war where people just sit in trenches. It's very dynamic and very exciting and very bloody and very awful in many ways. And it's, you know, it really needs to be studied at least as extensively as World War II.
And it is a great legacy, it's a great history, and it's, you know, important for the country.
Right, and I really hope that, that you'll get the listeners and the attention that you deserve.
Okay, Professor, we thank you greatly for your time and look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you very much, and your listeners can go subscribe to our show, ProfessorBoskill.com. As they know, and as I'm sure you've said, subscription to podcasts is always free and it's fun. And I hope that you enjoyed it. And I hope I can't wish you more success for your podcast. I hope you do wonderfully, and that it gets the message out.
Thank you. And Professor Buzzkill is a fun, cool way to either learn or, I guess, in many ways, relearn history. I certainly
hope so.
So that was our discussion with Dr. Joseph Kuhill, otherwise known as Professor Buzzkill. He is an interesting guy, has a great, unique perspective. We recommend you check out his website, ProfessorBuzzkill.com, and subscribe to the Professor Buzzkill podcast. Thanks for listening to our podcast, the All American Legacy Podcast. Next week on the All American Legacy Podcast, we're going to wrap up our discussion on World War I and talk about what exactly happened to the division between 1919, the end of World War I, and its reconstitution for World War II. Here's a preview. At the time, there was no real role for a peacetime army in the way that we think of ourselves as the army right now. You know, World War I came to an end, and the country didn't really understand having a fully functioning standing army with no war.